Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update, and he is in Poland, Warsaw, Poland, speaking to us today. Malcolm, welcome back to JM and the AM.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you from far or near. It's hard to believe that it's only 48 hours since I left the Chevra and after a great Pesach, and now here in the polar opposite in Poland, having visited just now the cemetery where 250,000 Jews are buried, where you can literally live the history of centuries of Jewish life here.
I assume this is in conjunction with March of the Living. March of the Living every year literally leaves the United States and other countries right after Pesach?
It's always for Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day, which is on Sunday. And I had the privilege this year of being asked to be the speaker at the March of the Living and an additional program that will be on Sunday and broadcast all over the United States. I know some of the communities in New Jersey are participating in a special commemorative ceremony, and I'll be speaking there first on Sunday and Monday at Auschwitz-Birkenau at the ceremony itself. I know Rabbi Lau, the chief rabbi, former chief rabbi of Israel, and Chaim Adler, the Chazan, is going to be here, and the Attorney General of Israel, other officials are coming, and about 10,000 marchers. And wherever you go now, you see people, adults and young people, who have come here. And I think it's about 23 years since it was started, and it's a very meaningful and important program. I won't be going to Israel, but the vast majority of the people go from here then to Israel for an additional week, and then you go from, you know, and they liken the Seder, Mishibud Lugula, Me'afelu La'or Gadol, when you go from seeing the degradation and the terrible things that happened here to the gula of being in Israel.
A couple of things I want to point out. First of all, in addition to Jersey, I know in West Hampton also they're doing something that will be Sunday morning here in conjunction with March of the Living, and I believe some of those events are up on our community calendar, so people should check that out. I think that's I don't think it's been done before in different locations
right.
In that manner, so people should really check that out, and if it's in their neighborhood, certainly try to go. The other thing I wanted to tell you was that in Israel, I believe, as was done last year, they're actually moving Yom HaShoah, the observance in the state, to Monday. They've done this recently, and again, Sunday in some places like where you are on the 27th of Nisan, and then Monday in Israel and other places, we'll do something here Monday morning. The observance will continue, and that is done because of the fear that there might be Chilul Shabbos, if the program is in fact going to start Saturday night, as you know, logically would be, because Sunday's the 27th of Nisan. I think
it is Sunday night and Monday here as well, but there are additional programs on Sunday.
And I just want to point out that, you know, as everybody tends to jump to conclusions or make flippant comments about the state of Israel. Think about it that they are moving it. And it is moved by the Rabbanut specifically because of Shabbos. I wanted to make that point. The other thing I wanted to say was, this is just a curiosity. And look, many of us are familiar with your family's history when it comes to World War II. So you're certainly a great spokesman to this point. We've discussed it before on the air. But as you go again, and obviously with the time schedule, you're going to be spending Shabbos in Poland. That's quite obvious. I've been outspoken, and I come from, you know, a family that's been relatively outspoken about, you know, spending money in Eastern Europe and visiting these places. And there has been, you have to admit, some commercialization of some of the, sites of disaster for the Jewish people. Any different feelings on this whole issue, or you would still say it's meaningful and important for everybody to attend?
I think it's very meaningful for young people if it's done the right way, as they do it here, where I saw rabbis and guides with the groups going around. When you see the kvarim of so many great people, Chaim Soloveitchik, the Netziv, the Domsker, the Abder Rav, all in literally within a minute of each other, 2 minutes walking of each other. When you hear the real story of the Warsaw Ghetto, when you see the lives of individuals, that it brings the reality home to young people. And, you know, we're in danger because we live in a generation of forgetfulness overall, and you see already the rise of the deniers and the diminishers and the those who denigrate the Holocaust and what happened, that it's important that we keep alive, that people remember their lives, the sacrifice, and also reminds us of our responsibilities. And therefore, I think that it is important. I agree that there is sometimes commercialization of the Shoah, and there's people who exploit it, but I see the young people here who were cleaning up in the cemetery. There's none of them can go away not being impacted and affected by it.
Understood. I as long as you touched on that one issue, because I figured someone like yourself has to at least be irked a bit by concentration camps being turned into some type of tourist attraction, let's put it that way.
But that's why it's called the March of the Living. It's not about death. It's about the rebirth, and it's the fact that here the Nazis wanted to destroy all the Jewish life, all of Jewish life. Warsaw was a third Jewish. You know, the Warsaw Ghetto, you had 400,000 people almost living here in Warsaw. The stories tend to be forgotten, but also the quality of Jewish life, the learning, and that the way we make their deaths meaningful is what we do in life, is to rebuild it and to reassert it and to learn the lessons of that period.
Well,
and it's not a march of death. It's a march of the living.
As usual, I think you have the right perspective. All right, there's so much going on, and you can't imagine over the last 48 hours how the listeners of this show have reacted to news from the Middle East. There's a lot to talk about. Let me just ask you quickly before we talk about Egypt and the PA, which are the topics of the day as far as I'm concerned. Has anybody taken responsibility for this terror attack in Marrakesh?
There has been not as far as I know yet.
But it has the workings of who behind it, you know, based on what based on the MO of terror attacks.
Well, we have seen, first of all, there were in the past terror attacks which Al-Qaeda type groups have been involved in. Secondly, and the government has been extremely responsive and really works hard at it, and the king deserves all the credit that we can give him and support, because they not only are good to their Jews and have fought terrorism seriously, and he has moved in the direction of reform. But lately, we've seen again that we've seen demonstrations there where 10,000 people last week demonstrated. Iran has been meddling inside Morocco for a long time, and about 6-8 months ago, I think, Morocco broke diplomatic relations with Iran and forced them to withdraw their ambassador to protest the fact that Iran was meddling, as they did in Egypt, as they did in Bahrain, as they did and doing in Saudi Arabia and Yemen and elsewhere. And there is also Al-Qaeda of North Africa, which is really based in Algeria. We don't hear about Algeria, but there's a lot going on. There are demonstrations and protests there as well. Some of the countries are better able to clamp down on any media coverage. And a lot of these places just not of that much interest.
The terror,
Morocco is very critical.
The terror net continues to expand, or as you might say, continues to be exposed. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll get to everything, I hope, or at least we'll touch on everything that folks are interested in. We have to talk about Fatah and Hamas, but I'm going to go backwards. 24 hours ago, I would have said this segment would have began with Fatah and Hamas and their deal, which we will discuss, but now we see an article in the New York Times this morning: in shift, Egypt warms to Iran and Hamas. Egypt is planning to open the blockaded border with Gaza and normalizing relations with two of Israel's and the West's Islamist foes, Hamas and Iran. How is this going to manifest itself, Malcolm, and is this a big shock that Egypt has made these overtures?
It came a lot faster than we had thought. It wasn't a shock that it happened. There have been signs all along, although the military has generally been very much against it. This is an initiative primarily of Al-Arabi, who is the foreign minister, and has long harbored such views, as has Baradei, who's one of the candidates for president. But there was a poll this week done by the Pew Research, which is a neutral source, and it showed that by 54-36%, Egyptians want the peace treaty with Israel annulled. 20% of Egyptians had a favorable opinion of the U.S., while almost 80% an unfavorable opinion, and 43% want a more distant relationship with the United States. So it's not just about Israel, it's about the whole direction that this is taking. We're seeing the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're seeing also the results, I think, of some mistakes in American foreign policy. But overall, what the outreach to Iran, which has long tried to topple the Egypt and has tried to sow not only unrest but to create disturbances, sending in terrorists to try to destabilize them. There's been an ancient rivalry between Egyptians and Persians who look down upon each other, and to see Iran now being brought back. Secondly, Egypt and the army had, and certainly under Mubarak, had taken steps, including building that security fence, which is now stopped at the most critical place, and the flow of weapons into Gaza continues, even though the Egyptians did stop a convoy from Sudan. But overall, this is a trend which I think should be of great concern, and they were the ones who brokered the Hamas Fatah deal. Mubarak all along had been controlling Hamas and working against it. Now we see that all the restrictions and constraints are being diminished, if not removed.
For those of us who are completely confused now about the hierarchy and associations in the Egyptian government, is this foreign minister the one who operated under Mubarak or not?
No. This is a different foreign minister who was appointed. He was the guy when Sadat made the deal with Israel. He opposed it. He's been inside and outside of government for many years, but he was brought in after this new revolution, the revolution that took place. And by the way, we should also note that they blew up again the Egypt-Israel gas pipeline.
Right.
And that many of the oil ministers or energy ministers are under arrest and being investigated, as is Mubarak, for the deal they made with Israel, claiming that the price is too low. So we might well see some sort of an attempt to renegotiate or even to stop it. And there have been demonstrations in Cairo against the deal, the gas deal, renewing the energy deal between Israel and the United States and Egypt. And for Israel, it's very important because the cost of this energy is much, much less than reverting to coal, which they're having to do, or importing or using diesel or heavy oil.
So was the pipeline
also pollutes.
The pipeline explosion, there was speculation that it was a vigilante activity. Is it possible that it was done with the approval and, sort of a wink-wink from the current Egyptian government?
I don't think it's being done because they need the money, and the generals are not people who would support it, I think. But it does reflect some of what is really happening, and something I've spoken about for a long time, and we've discussed on the show. I have been to Cairo since the revolution, and as I said, that what you see on the surface is not right. What's really happening. And it's true in other parts of the Middle East, but Egypt is not just another country. People have to understand the seriousness that 50% of Israel's defense planning had to do with Egypt. It's a power. It's got huge weapons. The United States has provided every year $3 billion in weapons, or over $2 billion in weapons now since the signing of the Camp David Accords. So there's a huge infrastructure, military infrastructure. It's a huge country, and it is a bellwether country in the region.
The polls that you just mentioned, were there similar numbers, a year or two ago when it comes to Egyptian support for Israel and what the average Egyptian citizen thinks of the U.S. and Israel? I mean, where did these numbers come from suddenly?
Well, I wouldn't say it's sudden, and I would say that you're actually pointing to an important fact that we've seen this trend. By the way, when you ask Jordanians, 99% of them, hate Israel and don't want to have relations with it. And if you go across the Arab world, the results were equally disturbing and negative, with almost no exceptions. What I point out to you is that it's against the United States, and maybe it's a message to all of those who are trying to drive wedges between the United States and Israel, is that the two are interlocked because they stand for the same things. We're trying to fight for democracy and freedom. And they become the targets then of the extremist elements. So I would not say that this is as radical a change as the numbers would indicate when you look back at some of the previous figures.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is live in Poland on this Friday, Erev Shabbos, here at JM in the AM. The two main Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, announced Wednesday they're putting aside years of bitter rivalry to create an interim unity government and hold elections within a year, a surprise move that promised to reshape the diplomatic landscape of the Middle East. What's the story with this deal? What is this deal all about?
Well, as you know, that there have been attempts for a long time to try and broker some sort of reconciliation. Mubarak was very angry at Hamas because after he had extended himself on it, they at the last minute reneged. It happened several times. I think Abbas is looking at the prospect of elections in September. I think the Egyptians offered him an opportunity. The Hamas took it because they know that they're moving towards this vote in September at the United Nations, that the PA is, the Palestinian Authority, and they're looking at this as that they want to be on board that vote. Also, for Fatah, you know, one of the arguments was, well, how can you say you want a state when you don't represent, you represent only half of the Palestinian people when Gaza is under Hamas? This way, they can come to the UN and say, well, we have a unity government representing everybody. As you know, Fayyad, who is the favorite child of the West, is being excluded, and he's seen as an arch enemy by Hamas. And Abbas is willing to pay the price. I think he's even willing to pay the price of U.S. aid. At least he has said so. And many members of Congress, and I hope your listeners and you will encourage them to write to the members, to encourage them to continue to speak out as they have. And this is not stimulated by the lobby or anything. This is members of Congress recognizing what America has at stake and why this is a terrible move. And we can continue to give hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year to a Palestinian Authority that is using it without stopping incitement and using it for purposes that we could find really deleterious to America's interests.
By the way, much different than White House reaction, incidentally, unless the media is not giving it the attention that it should.
I think the United States came out against it. They made it very clear. I think the administration has also said that this could jeopardize U.S. assistance, and Abbas's answer essentially was, we're prepared to pay that price.
But why didn't the White House react more in terms of the peace negotiations with Israel? I understand the financial aspect of this, but shouldn't the White House be out there saying that we do not accept that a joint Fatah-Hamas group could possibly negotiate peace with Israel?
Well, there are two things. One is, if you've seen how they have said that in regard to Syria, and they said that, you know, that they've been pushing towards trying to renew negotiations, and they say they understand under these circumstances that it would be impossible for Israel, and they're dropping it. And then in regard to the Hamas issue, they have made some statements. I'm not going to say it's everything everybody would have wanted to hear, but you know, after Palestinian leaders said they prefer peace with Hamas over peace with Israel, and saying if you would take polls, no Palestinian group is a terror organization, or I mean, just everything about it. I will tell you, most Israelis are skeptical about it. Most don't believe this can last. And the only way that ever could be any kind of talks again would be if Hamas dismantles its terrorist infrastructure, recognizes Israel, and previous agreements with the PLO. That's also the position the United States has taken. So I think that they have said it very clearly. They've come out now, I think, uniquely. I didn't hear much criticism coming from the Europeans and from others. Right. I do think the administration put some markers down.
There are some Jewish groups. There are some organizations aligned with Israel's future, let's put it that way, who are celebrating the end of the Palestinian state at this point. Based on your analysis, it sounds like what happened between Fatah and Hamas could accelerate things in the UN. Is there a valid position here that this could really put an end to the UN effort in terms of declaring unilaterally a Palestinian state?
No, I do not think so, because I think you can get an automatic majority no matter what from the non-aligned movement and the Organization of Islamic Countries, etc.
Even with Hamas involved, it's irrelevant.
Even with Hamas involved, it might affect the votes of countries, let's say Britain, France, others. And Netanyahu is going to meet Sarkozy and he's also going to Great Britain to meet the Prime Minister, I think, Cameron. And I'm not sure. No, there was no third country now, but they are talking about additional visits. And certainly he's supposed to come to the United States and address a joint session of Congress and meet the president. But I think that in view of these developments, he might want to reconsider giving that speech, because there isn't much he can say given these developments until they clarify, and should not take the focus off of what Abbas has done that shows his true colors. I believe that this will enhance the drive towards a September deadline. It may knock off a few of the Western countries, but will not overall affect the ability to get a majority.
Do you also believe that for those who want to see Netanyahu stay away from the negotiating table, this will in fact lengthen that period of time in terms of how much time he'll spend away from the table?
I think it has to. There's no way you can go to the table when the negotiating party and partner, the supposed partner, is sitting there with people who say, we're not going to recognize you, we're never going to make peace with you.
And we're out to destroy you. And we're out to destroy you.
And we're going to destroy you, right. And then you sit down and say, okay, but let's see what we can give you. That can't be. And I don't think that the international community, the few normal parties there, and in this case, I think the United States has said it, you know, understands where Israel is coming from and what the reservations would be. And look, it comes in the context of the shooting at Kever Yosef.
Right.
We've seen so many things over the last, you know, weeks, as you said. There's so many issues, almost impossible to talk about any one of them. The skepticism, I think, that Barak and others have expressed has a basis in past history. But one time it will happen, and it could well be that this could pave the way for Hamas to have an even greater hold, both in elections that cover the West Bank or what they will call the Palestinian areas altogether.
You know, for those who complained over the stay that I had at Kutcher's that you'd never give us any good news, folks, Malcolm just told us that there are some normal countries out there in the international community. There's some normal parties out there. That's good news, because a lot of people don't think there's anybody normal anymore when it comes to parties.
First of all, I don't know how you define what is good or bad. Knowledge, getting facts, is not bad news. It's what enables you and empowers you and is the good news, because once you know, you can act. Ignorance is bad news. Mm-hmm. Not knowing and not being told. And if people don't want to know the truth, they can click the dial. You know, I'm here in Warsaw. There were a lot of people who didn't want to hear the bad news. They paid a price for it. We have to face reality. And right now, the reality is so complex and so immediate and so important. You know, we're fighting the unilateral declaration that will come September, or Durban 3 that is happening. We're going to have flotillas again in May or June.
Right.
We see the changes in Turkey and all of these countries where massive changes taking place, and no one who knows the area can tell you what the outcome of all of this will be.
I love how the flotilla...
You're giving them the greatest service in the world, is just to tell them the truth.
I love how the flotilla warnings are already starting at Israel.
Well, but they're coming, and they're coming, and they're talking about 15 ships. The Turks are working behind it. Many governments, the United States, by the way, and Susan Rice made a good speech in which she addressed both Goldstone and called for the UN to stop any further action on it, but also hit the flotilla and talked about the countries that assist them in this. But, you know, all the countries, everybody, is just looking at this whole region where Assad could face charges in the International Criminal Court on the one hand. The other hand, he's cracking down and crushing, you know, the rebellion. Egypt is facing increasing dissatisfaction, and on one hand, people say, well, they're satisfied with progress. On the other hand, saying we're not satisfied with the progress. We see the tensions still in Bahrain. We know Basiji are going from, who are the extreme elements of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, are doing their own flotillas to Bahrain, sending hundreds at a time.
With no media attention.
Nobody cares. And look at the Christians in Lebanon. Who writes about what's going on in Lebanon, that they're standing off against Hezbollah? Nobody cares. And it's really a horrific commentary about the era in which we live, when you have instant communication and the impact of the Twittering and Facebooking and all this other stuff, and yet the mainstream media ignoring so many of these realities.
Malcolm, there's a big party going on in Great Britain. Come on.
That's true, and that's what everybody wants to see. People getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and, you know, even people who have said things to me. And then I tell them, but you know, look what's happening in Syria. And you know what's interesting on the Syrian front? Something... I think I mentioned that if you look, when they talk about the Syrian army, it's not the Syrian army. It's the 4th Division, which is run by Assad's brother. And recently, during this week in Deraa, where a lot of the confrontations have taken place, the 5th Division, which was deployed together with the 4th Division, challenged and tried to stop the 4th Division from going in. And, you know, so they present this monolithic front as if the army in Syria, as opposed to other places. The army in Syria is largely controlled by Alawites and other leaders of minority groups. They know the consequences. For Assad, there is no option. There's no national army to take over. If he falls, there could be massacres of the Alawites. There would be total dissolution of the country. I think you could end up with six states in some sort of confederation. The Iranians are investing more and more, not only sending weapons, they even send cameras that go into the traffic lights so they could take pictures of the demonstrators, and then at night they go and arrest them. The media almost ignores these things.
Why is it so hard to get the UN to criticize Syria? Why does it seem like that's a...
Because they have allies. First of all, they're the other Arab countries. Second of all, China protects them, and Russia, because Russia is looking to expand its influence in the region. This is a cheap way for them to do it. Also, none of these guys want to start having Chechnya raised. They don't want the situations in some of the Western provinces in China and the Xinjiang and the other places where they're so repressive and against the Dalai Lama and his followers and many others.
But when the Egyptian protests,
a lot of them have an interest in keeping these issues.
But when the Egyptian protests began and we saw things in Tunisia, Bahrain, etc., was there UN reaction or not?
There were resolutions, but there wasn't because you didn't have massive casualties.
Right, the crackdown.
In 19 days, in 9 days, I think they had 70, 80.
That's but the exception
you're
in Syria.
You're in the hundreds. Nobody knows how many people have been killed.
It doesn't have the look of an overthrow. And yet,
here, Syria is now running for a seat on the Human Rights Council. If anything can point up the hypocrisy of that body and the stupidity of it, of the situation. And we're also seeing how the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria is different than it was in other countries because Assad, the father, crushed them. And whereas they are about 30% in Egypt, they're probably half of that in Syria. And many of the Sunnis really oppose a role for them in the government. Some in Egypt also, you have serious numbers that oppose it. And the role of Al Jazeera. Look at Al Jazeera is focusing on Syria, really going after the Assad regime day in, day out with broadcasts and showing injured people and really some horrific portrayals. So Al Jazeera has now become a major force in trying to stimulate this. And, of course, Syria has an answer to all of this, that this is a Zionist plot.
Right. And the difference is years ago, a media outlet like that would never have been independent, right? It would have been all state-controlled.
Well, it is essentially state-controlled. It's, as one Arab leader said, Qatar is a country built on a television station. It is run and subsidized probably to the tune of almost $100 million a year by the Qatari government, much to the annoyance of the Egyptians and others. But what we've seen emerge now more clearly is the Tehran-Syrian axis, even though they're Shiites and the Syrian population is largely Sunni, but they want to protect their closest Arab ally. They want to assure their interests, which means also the pipeline to Hezbollah and other things, and they're saying, look, if another government comes in, and we've seen demonstrators yelling, we will not die for Hamas, we don't want to die, we won't die for Hezbollah, as they did in Iran after the elections. So, this is a very serious development. And they look at the Hamas side, which is also backed by Iran, and, it could well be the better organized, the better armed side that could challenge or overrule the Palestinian Authority as the dominant force.
So we've always viewed Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Hamas as one party, so to speak. Hezbollah, of course, in there as well.
Very good point.
The fear this week is that we are probably adding Egypt to that ledger.
Right. And one of the problems, I think your point is really well taken, is that we lump people together, even in countries. And we don't understand the tribal structures, the differences, that the borders are all artificial. They were imposed by Europeans at different periods and not of historically, within the last century primarily. And that, these are artificial structures. And you break down along tribal and other ethnic religious lines. And you have the two overlays, which I spoke about at the Hever extensively. So people understand that you have overlaying this the Sunni-Shiite battle of 900 years standing. You have the, which is then translated into Iran-Syria, Iran-Saudi Arabia battle. which all then you can look at each of the situations and say, how do these things play out? The price of food going up and the inability of countries to match, and then therefore removing subsidies or raising the prices and people rebel. You have also then the communications revolution. There are a lot of factors that come into play, and you have to look at all of them and the structure of the country. Libya is a problem because it's broken into three, really, and there are tribal differences that are very significant that play into it. And if you notice, Gaddafi was saying, well, he's going to turn it over to tribal leaders. He didn't, but he understands how to exploit those differences.
It's amazing. And I think about what you're saying, it's so true. I mean, anybody who went from grade school and beyond has always been taught geography and history, you know, in one lump sum, so to speak. And only now do these tribal differences, which I'm completely unfamiliar with, now do they play such an important role, and it's so impossible to keep track of them.
If you take Syria alone, you have the Druze, you have Kurds, you have the Christians, a few Jews, you have the two different Sunni areas, you have the Alawites, at six different sectors. And, you know, he held it together using the Alawite infrastructure, dominating it, which created immense resentment. And when I said that, you could have easily a backlash against him because of it.
Unbelievable. All right, couple of quick things before we wrap up. Any evidence one way or the other in terms of the murder of Ben Yosef Livnat, which all of us read about or saw over the holiday? Do we know if the PA acted as properly in terms of their policing the area of Kever Yosef, or in fact they were terrorists who were dressed as PA policemen? Anybody have a clue what happened there?
Well, they have pretty good information. Israelis, it's being investigated still, but both sides. But clearly the people went there to daven. I think this happened on the way out, that they went through or challenged a blockade or roadblock of the Palestinians, and then this guy opened fire. By the way, a number of people were wounded, which is also
right.
Doesn't get mentioned much.
Right.
And by Ben Yosef Livnat was killed. Which was it's a real tragedy. He had four children, and he went to daven there. Whether they followed the rules, I think is clear that they did not get permission or didn't coordinate it with the army. The army does take them in to go at different times, but frankly, these guys know they didn't pose a threat. They now try to paint against the settlers, you know, as wild people, and you know that they posed a danger, and the government. Ministers who are saying, well, it's legitimate, you know, they were upholding the law and they were doing it, rather than, you know, Israel is forced to condemn when they kill known terrorists and go after them. But here you had people who they knew what they came for, they knew what they do it regularly, and yet the there's no sympathy whatsoever reflected in any of the press.
Oh, that's for sure. All right, Malcolm, you're in Poland. Did you hear where 78-year-old Bronco Lustig is going to be celebrating his bar mitzvah?
Yes, and I'm going to be with him on Monday. And he is actually here already.
In front of barrack number 24, where he was as a 13-year-old.
Exactly, and didn't have his bar mitzvah at the time.
That's an unbelievable story, and you will be there as an eyewitness this coming.
And it's getting immense coverage, I understand, everywhere, because he's a Hollywood figure, and right. You know, he won two Academy Awards, and he has been very taken with this whole process. So yes, that will be happening here.
Unbelievable. I want to remind everybody that this coming Sunday at the Iranian Mission to the UN, 3rd Avenue and East 40th Street, a Yom HaShoah vigil. A Yom HaShoah vigil remembering the 6 million, and of course, with special focus on what's happening in this crazy world of ours today. Sunday, 12 noon at the Iranian Mission to the UN, a Yom HaShoah vigil, 3rd Avenue and East 40th Street in New York City. Malcolm, I guess enjoy Poland, or I don't know what to say. Have a meaningful trip, let's put it
right.
That way.
A meaningful experience, and I hope that my words will be meaningful for the young people who are here. To talk about why I think it's significant and what the significance of the place is. And I hope that people, you know, Yom HaShoah should be a day of reflection. If never again is to have meaning, it can't be just a hollow phrase. It has to be something that each generation, a pledge that we renew in every generation. And this is a time, you know, we just scratched the surface of some of the challenges that are facing us, this worldwide and global campaign on delegitimization that is going on. You know, the political changes in the world, the fact that you have massive migrations now into Europe and elsewhere from results of this is something that nobody even thinks about what the ramifications of these things will be. But if never again is to be meaningful, and if we really mean it, then it has to be translated into action and into deeds. And everybody can translate it the way they feel best. Fila is one way to do it. Learning is another way. Reinforcing Jewish communities, making sure every child has a Jewish education, making sure that in our schools we teach about the Shoah. There are now wonderful new books, Mrs. Lichtenstein's and others, the one from Cleveland, and there are many good books that can be used. There's no excuse anymore why we aren't teaching and teaching the lessons of it, teach about the life and to teach about the message. 1.5 million Jewish children died. Every one of their memories should be kept alive by a Jewish child today. And that is the way we bring real meaning to the phrase never again.
Malcolm, excellent. Have a good Shabbos. We'll speak Bezrat Hashem next week. Malcolm Honlein, live in Poland. He's Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.